Ian Watkins was someone who literally had it all. Good looks, talent, charisma, fame, and success. However, beneath the surface, he was hiding sick and twisted fantasies. Watkins used his power, notoriety, and influence that the stardom he was blessed with gave him for evil, targeting vulnerable people to satiate his horrific desires. The details of this case are extremely disturbing. This is the case of Ian Watkins, from rockstar to ruin. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. So let's take a look at who Ian Watkins was, who people believed he was, at least back in the day, before we hear about the heinous crimes that he's guilty of. So he was born on the 30th of July, 1977, which I find a little bit disrespectful. My own daughter has just been born on the 30th of July, 1977. I would like to change his date of birth. That would not be fair for anybody else being born on the day I changed it to. But you know what I mean? How dare he share his date of birth with my child's date of birth. So currently he's 46 years of age. He's from Pontypridd in Wales. And when I took a look at his background, he was a pretty outstanding young person with respect. He was incredibly bright, very articulate. He was somebody who always wanted to be quite popular. But when it comes down to his academic prowess, you know, he was a straight A student. So he's an individual who isn't just blessed in the looks department, he isn't just blessed in the charisma department, he's actually blessed in the intellect department. And I guess on one level, that detracts from our expectations of who criminals will be. But when you think about narcissistic psychopathic tendencies, actually, a lot of those individuals do tend to be higher in their intelligence level than the rest of the population. So arguably, this is something that means he's going to be good at manipulation. If you're really super bright and super charismatic, clearly if you are an individual with a high intellect and socially awkward skills, then it's not going to be easy for you to do what he does. But when you have the charisma and personality and drive and intellect, I think they collude and collide in a way that can be incredibly helpful for you if you do want to be malevolent, because people look at you and expect a different set of circumstances than what's going on in the subtext of your mind and experience and activity. But also, you are just blessed fundamentally with the gift of the gap. And that means that you can coerce people more easily than people who would struggle because they don't have the intellect or charisma. And that together makes you essentially somebody who could be very dangerous. He grew up in a good family. Genuinely, a good family. He had a very nurturing mother, very decent stepfather. Of course, we can look in there and say, well, there must have been some dysfunction because mum and dad weren't together, as in biological parents. But I mean, it's so common these days. I am a divorcee myself. Therefore, you can kind of see that even when he was growing up, this was something that was becoming more commonplace. And he gets on really well with his mother and his stepfather. When I look at whether there is any investigations in his childhood, there are none. So there's no history of abuse. He never talked about being abused. It wasn't entered into court that he had suffered abuse, because these are all, of course, mitigating factors. If somebody has gone through the court system and it turns up that they've experienced and endured the most horrific experiences of kids, understandably, we are going to give them a level of leniency. It's not going to excuse the way that they've behaved. But we'll give them a level of leniency because of the fact that we understand that fractures in foundations can cause big problems as individuals grow older. And none of that's entered into the court case. He also academically carries on thriving. So we don't see this very bright kid who's getting straight A's at school start declining in teenagehood, which does happen. We see incredibly bright, articulate, clever young people start to fall in with the wrong crowd or get involved with subcultures that are unhelpful for them. And then that intelligence really is used in a way that tends to procure things in a negative context and a positive context. That's not what we're seeing with Ian Watkins at all. He actually goes on to university, and he gets a first class honours degree in graphic design from the University of Wales. Now, I've been to university. I'm sure a lot of you have been to university. We all know that the first class honours is the highest of the high level in what you are actually studying. And so he's clearly very, very academically connected. And the people who knew him prior to what we find out about this monster, I am using the word monster very specifically and I believe highly accurately about Ian Watkins, he's described by other people as very personable, very charming, and he was somebody who seemed from a very early age to want to be involved in a band. So as a young teen, he gets involved with others, they connect, they start playing music together. These tend not to work out, but he does it a good few times before arriving at the place and position where he becomes super famous, which is to be the lead singer and also the songwriter of The Lost Prophets. And The Lost Prophets did exceedingly well. So first of all, not that I'm some kind of individual with this incredible knowledge about singer-songwriters and bands in the UK versus the US, but when I was doing my research, one of the things that I came across is, first of all, they sold over 3.5 million albums worldwide. This is over a 15-year career that they were together. But that's a huge amount of records and albums to sell worldwide. Was I showing my age then? Records. You know, the old vinyl. Yeah, we've all got one of those, haven't we, in the attic? No, young people, you're probably thinking, what is she on about? But in my day, when you bought an album, it was on vinyl. It was a record. Or you had a tape, which you would inadvertently screw up loads of times in your tape player and have to get a pencil to kind of put it all back in place. Anybody under the age of 25 is probably thinking, has she lost her mind? She's just rambling about things that make no sense. The point is, aside from showing my age, that 3.5 million albums worldwide is huge. And also, they made a massive mark in America. So the UK is obviously a place where people sell albums and they have tours and they do very well. And they do excellently, notably in the UK. But getting yourself out there and becoming super successful in the States, that is really impressive. And they managed to do that. That American success is arguably incredibly rare for UK bands. And because of this, they were doing all the things that every single rock star dreams in their head when they're imagining becoming that rock star of doing, which is playing at high profile festivals and just being taken really seriously for their art, which their music is. Now, the band originally got together in 1997, but eventually it disbanded in 2013, and obviously it disbanded because Watkins had been arrested and Watkins' trial had started, and the band did not want to be associated with the grotesque malevolence and abuse that Watkins was being tried for. And I'm not going to tell you, if you've been abused, not to watch this. I know that people do trigger warnings where crime is concerned. I don't want to, because I think that, first of all, it underestimates individuals who have been horribly abused. I think the resilience of those individuals tends to be very high, and also their compassion and connection with children who have faced the monsters that we're going to discuss today. They are individuals who feel a complete compassion and empathy with this situation and also have this desire to protect kids. So just to know, if you are watching this and you have been abused, it is going to be really graphic. But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't listen, because I personally feel that looking at the Ian Watkins trial, it really helped me to connect with just how seriously we take child abuse and just how seriously we take the perpetrators of that abuse, even when they happen to be super famous. And I personally believe there's a lot of evil in the world around the abuse of children. I've worked in sex trafficking. I've worked in sexual exploitation. I've had the privilege of working with individuals who have had horrific things happen to them. I know that there are really nasty, grotesquely abusive adults who are out there trying to use children for their own gratification. And it's heartening to me when somebody like Ian Watkins, who essentially is in a position where he's got a lot of money, he's got a lot of influence, and in spite of that, the abuse and what he does within that abuse is so devastating that it wouldn't have mattered literally if he walked on water. He was going to be dragged to the place that he deserved to be, which of course is incarcerated. So like I said, I'm not giving a trigger warning about the information that I'll go through in the trial. It is very graphic. What I want to do is to share with you a story which I think demonstrates just how much we care about young people and children and babies and how we desire their safety above anything else. Now, one of the things that was very problematic for Ian Watkins was his drug use. Originally, when he was younger, he was straight edge. So I'm somebody who's plant-based. I'm an individual who doesn't drink alcohol. I'm an individual who doesn't take drugs. That's straight edge. It means that you are an individual who refuses to take anything that alters your mind. You are compos mentis constantly. And a lot of vegans are straight edge because they feel that that's the most profound way to live. I'm not saying it is, by the way. I'm just saying that that is a mentality. So I can remember being introduced when I was younger, when I wasn't straight edge at all, to a guy who I ended up dating, and he was. And it was kind of mind-blowing for me. I was like, this guy's vegan, he doesn't drink, he doesn't take drugs, he doesn't get smashed in any way. And it was only over time that I could see why. And it was to do with that sense of being completely at peace with who you are as a human being and being okay being who you are. Like I said, it took me a very long time to get to a point where I thought that was a good idea. I used to enjoy having fun when I was younger. But arguably, it says to me, psychologically, that maybe Watkins knew about potential predilections. And if you know about potential predilections, then you know that when your inhibitions are lowered, there is a potential for those predilections that are not acceptable societally to come through. So let's take, for example, you are an individual who is a virtuous paedophile. Now, I know that the word virtuous paedophile sounds like a juxtaposition. How can you be virtuous and also be attracted to children? Well, because you don't act on the feelings. So there are groups of men and women who are engaged in these groups called virtuous paedophiles. It means they offer each other support and they help each other to maintain the legality of behaviour so that they don't stray and do anything horrible to children. And they are obviously individuals who recognise that they have a huge, huge problem. And it must be awful in that situation and circumstance to know that you are attracted fundamentally to these innocent beings and you are attracted on a sexual level. But because they know about, firstly, the impact on the victim, but secondly, the consequences for themselves as well, they abstain from any kind of contact in a negative way with children. And those individuals, it's likely they often maintain behaviour by not doing things like taking drugs or alcohol because of the way that can shift and change your psyche. So this is just me, perception-wise, considering a possibility that Ian Watkins doesn't do things like take drugs and drink when he's younger because he has this sense that something awful could happen if he did. So he's this straight edge individual and it's basically a straight edge band initially, but then we get to 2007, 2008, and this is of course at the height of his fame. He'll be moving in circles that he's not used to moving into some degree because he's getting more and more famous. And I think there is an accessibility and acceptability of drugs and alcohol when you are a rock star. In fact, I would say that there is almost a push to have you fit that paradigm of what a rock star looks like. And he starts taking drugs. But we're not talking about an individual who dabbles. We're not talking about somebody who recreationally enjoys themselves on occasion. We're talking about an individual that becomes highly dependent. And that dependency starts to really affect and impact on the performance that he has on stage. And his bandmates start to become more and more concerned about this because, first of all, when you've got your main songwriter actually screwing up to such a degree that it's being noted by you as a band member, but also by the public, first off, on a PR level, that can be absolutely disastrous. It doesn't matter that you are a really famous person who's known as a rock star. As soon as you start declining physically on stage, You are going to have the press picking you apart. You are going to have people wanting to stop working with you. You're going to become that loose cannon, and that's really problematic for all the other members of the band. And Stuart Richardson, so he was the bassist, he said, literally, we were expecting a call just telling us he died every single day for the last 18 months of the band. That's how prolific the drug use was. So we have a real dependency issue. But then add to that how that's going to affect and alter his mood, his psyche, his physiology, and how, if you've been keeping a boundary on your behaviour, that boundary is going to crumble because you are in a different state of mind. And those in the band said the change was just unbelievable. In fact, a guy called Gavin Allen, he was a music journalist at the time, he referred to it as a startling change in Watkins and his relationship with other band members. And that was written in 2007. He said, they used to be a group of friends, but in 2007, Watkins had been detached. In fact, he said that he'd previously struck him, the journalist, as a really good guy. And he wasn't anymore. In fact, people started to use words like arrogant. He was an individual who acted superior. He was somebody who didn't engage with the band members anymore, which is just absolutely dysfunctional, isn't it? If you are promoting a band, if you are part of that band, if you together have to connect to create an amazing show, if you're not even speaking and spending time with the other band members, it's going to have fractures that are very palpable to people watching. Now, in spite of him acting superior, acting arrogant, being really objectionable, according to what I've read, the rest of the band still massively cared for him. They cared for him because of their prior relationship with him. They cared for him because essentially how they earn money comes down to them connecting in a way that is good and positive and can be demonstrated to the public. And also, if you think that the lead singer of your band is going to die, it means you've got no security ever. You're putting all your eggs in one basket and that basket is basically breaking and the eggs are hitting the floor. In this case, Ian Watkins is so problematic that they are consistently concerned that he's literally not going to wake up every day. They staged multiple interventions. They were consistently trying to get him clean because they worried he was going to end up overdosing. And he did actually get clean from time to time. And band members said it was like having him back. He was returning. He was the old Ian Watkins that they'd been used to. And they had hope because when he was on his A game, when he was completely straight headed, he was a completely different human being. And again, psychologically, there is a part of me that thinks, aside from the reality of it changing his psyche when he's taking drugs and drinking, aside from it breaching boundaries, therefore, because his inhibitions are lowered so he can push those boundaries further and further and further in a malevolent direction, is there also a part of himself that's trying to anesthetize the reality of what grotesque thoughts he has in his head? So it's dualistic in nature. On one level, he hates that part of himself, potentially. Not saying this is a reality, but potentially, he hates himself, he hates the malevolence, he hates the dark thoughts, he hates his attraction to children, so he drinks and takes drugs to try to avoid, to some degree, confronting that reality, and at the same time, in doing so, it actually works in the opposite direction, so it's counterproductive, and it incites behaviours that he wouldn't ordinarily feel if he wasn't taking drugs. Like I said, that's just a theory, it's not actually something that I necessarily even believe. It's just posing the potential, the different strands of his thinking as to why he remains so drug addled for such a long time. Now in 2010, we get a really, really disturbing piece of information about Watkins. So it's reported to the police that he is selling drugs to minors. Yeah, literally to children. And the argument here that was put forward was, well, he's so drug dependent that he needs to actually sell drugs to minors to pay for his own drug habit. Now, call me a little bit on the suspicious front here. Call me a little bit, shall we say, cautionary about believing that. And the reason I think that that doesn't make sense is, how many 14-year-olds have you seen with loads of cash? Like, you might have the odd jobs, you might have generous parents, but at the end of the day, you aren't walking in, are you, with like suitcases of cash going, Mr. Watkins, I'll take 27 ounces and 2 tons of cocaine, thank you. It's just not realistic, is it? It's far more likely he is selling drugs to minors because he likes being around young people, he likes reducing their inhibitions when they're on drugs, and that gives him license to be able to do what he wants to do with them. That would make more sense to me. And at the time that this is all happening, and it's apparently, you know, just dealing to kids, it's claimed that he was using cocaine, crack, crystal meth, and heroin, all of which are obviously very high level class A's, incredibly dangerous when you mix them together. But also, we know that things like crystal meth makes people more aggressive, it makes people have far lower inhibitions, it makes people feel super overconfident, and it also makes them look like they're 69 when they're only 25. But who needs teeth? We get to September 2012. Now, bear in mind, Ian Watkins has been noted as a drug dealer to kids. The police take this very seriously. And in that month, they actually do a raid on Watkins' house in Pontypridd. They take laptops, they take mobile phones, and this is all because, of course, they want to check whether any of his technology is indicating that he is indeed selling drugs to kids. At the end of the day, he might be an A-lister, but when it comes down to crime, if you do the crime, you've got to do the time. So that's what the police are looking for. They're looking at his technology to see whether it links to what they're being told about him and the drugs. But of course, that's not what they find. The police could not for a second have imagined the depraved images, the depraved content, the depraved reality of this man's behaviour, because it's harrowing. And I'm going to go through what they found on the technology so you have a real understanding of what we're dealing with when we talk about this man being the monster that he is. And bear in mind, in spite of the fact that they literally have him banged to rights because this is all over his technology, he initially says that he's completely innocent. And he's pretty good, by the way, at convincing people who know him that he is entirely innocent. We'll look at that a little bit later on. But going back to what I said earlier, this is where being a high-level manipulator comes in. Because even in the face of horrific evidence, somebody like Ian Watkins has the capacity and capability to convince people that they've got it wrong. So the crimes that he initially gets charged with, count 18, this is in March 2007, he met what's known as TT, because obviously they don't name these young people in the court documents for their own protection. So TT was a 16-year-old girl. She was a virgin at the time that he met her. He got her to dress in a schoolgirl outfit. He then videoed them having oral, vaginal, and anal sex. He also asked her if she enjoyed being an underage slut. To add insult to injury, he also urinated on her face and then told her to drink it. So that's our introduction to the kind of things that he was doing. As far as he was concerned, consensually with these young girls, obviously it isn't consensual most of the time because of age, but nonetheless, think about how he's treating these young girls, particularly a young girl who's never actually had sex before. It's really scary that he would think that was acceptable. Then we've got count 19, and I've taken a selection of these to just show you the indication of what kind of a predator we're dealing with. So this is in August 2008, he meets KJ, another fan also, age 16. Again, videos them having oral sex, and she's also seen snorting white powder. Now I would argue that's gonna be cocaine or it's gonna be ketamine, but he's pushing this scenario onto these youngsters. You know, he's encouraging them to take drugs. Then we've got count 31. Wow. It's found to be in possession of 90 indecent photos of children, and the age ranges were between 2 and 14 years of age. Now, 45 of those images were level 4. For those of you who don't know what level 4 is, in the UK we have a grading system, which obviously goes from children being filmed in slinky underwear all the way through to deeply aggressive, penetrative sex, either with physical parts of an individual's body or with objects, for example. So 45 of those were level four, and that means penetrative sexual activity between children and adults. And two images were level five. And just to give you an idea of what level five would be, it would be sadism, so harming the child whilst also penetratively raping them, or it would be bestiality, that would be one that would fit level five, so animals being used. These kind of images are the worst type of images, and for every well-adjusted human being who's listening to this, I imagine that your stomach just flipped hearing that. The way I feel when I describe these kind of things, because I've had the absolute privilege of working with sexually abused children and with adults who've survived, and it makes me feel a rage that is hard to deal with, because I want to take action towards the person who has perpetrated these kind of crimes. And for every single picture, there is a victim and victims. And for every individual who puts their eyes on those pictures, they are perpetrators of abuse, because it means there is a need and a want and a desire for these horrific images. So arguably for me, there is no non-contact crime in these situations. There is just contact, because of the fact that a child has been used to present you with these horrific images, which these absolutely deviant wrongans basically get titillated by. Then there's count 32. So now we've got videos and images of extreme pornography. 22 images of them were bestiality, including oral and vaginal sex with dogs. So you can see the depraved spectrum that Watkins is involved in and where his predilections lie. You know, these charges alone, it just makes you wanna lock the person up and never let them out. Never get them in public again, never have them be around other human beings, because there is something so broken within them. And Watkins is an individual who has been cultivating these particular images, these excesses, these interests for a long period of time. Now let's move on to the other evidence, which is where he actually incited others to basically present him with their children. When I say that, it genuinely makes me want to be sick a little bit, because as a mother, and I don't think you have to be a mother, I don't think you have to be a parent to have these feelings. I'm sure that most of you who are listening to this right now have a few ideas about what you would like to do with somebody like Watkins if you had half an hour alone with him. But when it comes down to being a parent who cares for their child, or being a notable individual in the life of children, you would lie down and die to protect them. In fact, I always say this when I'm on tour with my Serial Killer Next Door tour. When I'm talking to the audience, I say that for well-adjusted human adults, even if you had to throw yourself in front of a train to save a stranger's child, you would do it, because we're hardwired to protect the most vulnerable. So when we hear about a case like Watkins, where he is so absolutely as far removed from that protective mechanism that we feel, and is in fact invested on the sadism and abuse of children, knowing that he's able to basically get mothers to present him with their kids, it's so disconcerting, because for him, he's radically removed from humanity. But for a woman who's birthed a child to actually feel that they're accepting of wanting their child to be abused by Watkins, what does that say about them? And believe me, there in court were a lot of arguments about how vulnerable these women were. No, absolute bullshit. I've worked with a lot of vulnerable women, a lot of vulnerable men. I've worked with individuals who have been brutalized. And I tell you what, if you went near their child, if you put a finger on their child without their permission, without their consent, then you better hope you'd run fast. Because I tell you what, they'll chase you and they'll keep going until they get you, and woe betide you when they finally catch up with you. The idea that we're using vulnerability as a potential excuse for allowing your child to be horrifically abused by this monster, I'm not accepting it. So let's go through these cases. So there's Watkins and B. So B meets Watkins in 2011. Now bear in mind, B at the time was only 19 years of age, and B's infant was just 10 months old. We're talking about an absolutely incredibly young child. Now, in March and April of 2012, the two of them have these in-depth discussions and conversations about the sexual acts that they are both going to inflict upon B's son. And this unbelievably leads to B and Watkins actually meeting physically at the Copthorne Hotel in Cardiff. Now, on March 21st, Watkins texted B saying this, "Come down this weekend and we can F him up again." B responds, "Tell me if you want to get your D-I-C-K in our boy." I mean, what I'm imagining doing to both of those individuals would not be allowed to be put on YouTube. It's as simple as that. But in my head, I have some images that make me feel slightly more comfortable with discussing this, just because I'm imagining what could happen to them in the next life, if not in this one. So she is agreeing. She's excited by this. And together, they are discussing how they can totally destroy, to some degree, this little boy, because physically, when you abuse a child that way, it's not just a psychological implication at 10 months old, it's the physical implication. B also talks about getting her son high on methamphetamine. So again, she's even thinking about how she can incite this situation and excite Ian Watkins even further by getting her kid on a high-level dangerous drug. Then we get the 2nd and 3rd of April, B and Watkins meet again, this time at the Key West Hotel in London. They record what happened that night on video. Imagine being one of the police officers who has to witness that. Imagine being a member of a jury who has to be shown things like that. Now, B actually gave Watkins her baby that particular evening so that he could rape him. He was going to rape him orally. He was going to rape him anally. And he really tries to do that. During this period, B is encouraging him actively throughout the encounter. Then she, as the parent, gives the little boy oral sex and even puts his hand on her vagina. Watkins masturbated the infant, and these depraved acts are all caught on camera. It is utterly incomprehensible to even begin to understand, even lightly connect with how a mother could do that. I always try to see it from different perspectives, but all I see are monsters. All I see is this beautiful, innocent little boy being horribly defiled by individuals who are meant to protect, and by an individual who literally gave birth to him, who should wish to run in front of traffic to prevent him from ever receiving any harm. The fact that she also texts Watkins a message on May the 24th, which says the boy is ready to be abused, means that B is actually somebody who understands fully what they are doing. It is abuse. This isn't a situation where she hasn't got a comprehension of the depravity of the two of them. She's responding to Watkins with those words because she knows damn straight what she is doing. We get to August the 2nd. Watkins messages B and says, "I think we've gone easy on him so far. Time to teach him and make him learn to love it. This is a 10-month-old little boy. It will be fear, terror, pain that he's feeling and facing. And he's just an object to them, an object for their own pleasure." And Watkins is basically now saying, "We're going to make him enjoy it." Well, you know what, Watkins? You don't get to make somebody do anything. The whole premise is that you can't make someone enjoy it. They either enjoy it or they don't enjoy it. And we all know this child would not be enjoying it. And just to imagine the physical harm that is occurring for this little child, because physically it is catastrophic, the kind of injuries that would be inflicted on him through this kind of abuse. And she is actively taking her child into the lion's den to impress, connect, and continue this relationship with Watkins, who is just a depraved monster. Now, Watkins and B actually meet at the Maldron Hotel in Cardiff, and Again, this demonstrates that they are consistently meeting up. And then on the September the 9th, B sends Watkins a photo. And again, she's actually orally abusing her son at this point. Now, in the court documents, counts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 relate to the abuse of this little boy by Watkins and B. And bear in mind the fact they actually videoed the abuse, that's considered an aggravating factor when it comes down to charging and bringing these individuals to justice, because it's clear they have it on video that both of them were enjoying the experience. They got great pleasure whilst committing the abuse. And it's sickening beyond belief that a mother would willingly do this to a defenseless child. What loving mother would do this and apparently enjoy it? And in fact, during the court case, Mr. Justice Royce commented about B and said that your infant would have trusted you implicitly. You totally betrayed that trust. That woman should not be allowed within 1,000 feet of any child, let alone her own child, in this life and every life, in this universe and every universe. She is a danger, a depraved, disgusting danger to kids. Also, the judge commented that B was manipulated by Watkins. I disagree. Listen, we all want to impress the new guy in our life or the new girl in our life. We've all done it. We've all wanted to be the person that's interesting, quirky, exciting, charismatic. You know, we all want to relate to that person by having interests that they enjoy. Of course, we all do that, but they are never things that cause others harm. The very fact that there is this imagined perspective that somehow B was manipulated by Watkins' influence and said, no. Nothing as a mother should influence you to harm your child. And the very fact that they bring that in, I just think there is a bias towards women. Oh, women aren't the kind of people who could be predators and perpetrators of sexual abuse towards kids. Yes, they can. And they do. So why do we try to limit this a little bit by suggesting she has a vulnerability? Screw that vulnerability. You are a heinous, horrible monster of a mother. A monster of a woman. You shouldn't even be allowed those titles, full stop. She should have protected her child at all costs, and instead she put him in the line of danger, and she encouraged that danger, and she consistently returned to ensure that danger continued. Then we have Watkins and the case of P. So this is another mother. These two begin communicating in August 2012. Now, P is 24 at the time of her sentencing, so she's just a little bit older than B. And these two were speaking about moving in with each other. Watkins actually messaged her and said, if you belong to me, so does your baby. Honestly, if I got a message like that, or a message that insinuated somebody wanted to abuse my kids, I would be at the police station quicker than you could say Jack Sprat. I would literally be there immediately. Because I would know this person have a malevolence and danger within them that means that they are comfortable having these conversations with somebody like myself, and therefore they're likely to have had conversations with other people. And if they're talking about wanting to abuse my child, then who other's children have they abused? But that doesn't work when it comes down to P. P replies, understandable, a mother-daughter slave duo worshipping you. What is wrong with these women? Watkins responded, that's all she will know. A life of filth. It's breathtaking. Like I said, when I was going through this information, it had to take breaks because the way I felt inside was just incandescent with rage and also in a state of disbelief that these women were so engaged with this immorality. So she's completely agreeing with him wanting her daughter this way. And she's also saying, I'll be a willing participant in it and I'll be your slave. And P and Watkins actually discussed also how she intended to share his penis with her daughter. She said, the good thing about babies is put anything in their mouth and they'll start sucking it. So this is not a vulnerable person. This is somebody who is thinking this out. They're getting excited by this depravity. Watkins went on to say that fat old men would pay thousands if she was whored out. He also said that she needs to know that mummy and daddy don't love her. She's just there to make us C-U-M. Even using the word daddy to actually describe himself in this context is reprehensible. People like him don't deserve to have that word associated with them in any way, shape or form. They both talk about torturing children for fun, and in particular, torturing this little girl for fun. There was a message that was all about planning to force the infant to also engage in bestiality, also to take drugs like crack cocaine. And he referred to that gorgeous child as his little F-U-C-K toy. The mother P in this case took pictures of her child's sexual parts, sent them to Watkins. Obviously, we know that's distributing child sexual images, which is completely illegal. And they will both be aware of this. But this demonstrates how untouchable Watkins believes he was. I mean, he is doing this openly with people. You know, he is having these conversations with these women who have bought into it. But how many women was he sending this kind of solicitation to? Because it's not just these two, is it? These are two that have actually bitten, they've taken the bait. But there'll have been many before them and would have been many after them if he got away with this. We get to the September the 12th. At this point, Watkins and P have a Skype call, and Watkins actually encourages P to digitally penetrate her child, and she does it with enjoyment, with relish. And then P sends photos of her further penetrating her daughter to Watkins. So she is fully invested. And I won't say what Watkins said in return to this situation, but it was absolutely stomach-churningly grotesque. He sexually pleasures himself throughout the call, and she knows that. So she knows he's being stimulated, and she's fully engaged with that. We get to October the 2nd, and these two meet again at the Travel Lodging Philly. October the 23rd, they meet at the Radisson in Cardiff. And the evidence actually suggests that P took a child to these encounters, because it stands to reason when you think about what I've just been through, but P denied that that was the case. She said that she left her baby with somebody else. Absolute bull. I mean, this is somebody who has embraced the abuse fully. She's excited by it. She doesn't seem to feel that she's doing anything wrong, and all she cares about is being with this man at a cost to her own flesh and blood. Seriously, it is absolutely shocking that this is something that she feels that she can mitigate by saying that she wasn't actually meeting up with him with her baby. Now, both of these pled guilty to conspiring to rape and conspiring sexual assault on this particular case, because they had all the evidence that they needed that demonstrated they were both engaged in this, and that was counts 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. They all relate to the abuse of this little girl by Watkins and by P. Now, Mr. Justice Royce, he said that Watkins regarded the little girl not as a human, but being simply a sexual object for their pleasure. And they're right. At the end of the day, whilst Watkins definitely was the one who organised and carried out most of the abuse, P lets her daughter down just enormously. She allowed it. She encouraged it. I believe she incited it as well. I think she was more than a happy participant. And again, Mr. Justice Royce said that P betrayed her child. I don't think that the word betrayed comes close to what we really feel about what that mother did. Mr. Justice Royce commented that this case breaks new ground and reaches new depths of depravity. Any decent person listening to this material will hear experience, shock, revulsion, anger, and incredulity. Now, another thing that really frustrates me is, bear in mind that Watkins has said he's not guilty all the way through. And in fact, the women were saying that they weren't guilty. And Watkins and P literally waited until just before the jury was sworn in on day two to actually enter their plea. So when they go guilty, I think the reason for that, again, is manipulation to some degree. They're given the standard 10% discount. I don't feel that they should have been given any credit whatsoever. If you wait till 2 days before the jury is sworn in to go guilty when you know that you're guilty as hell, that means that you were bloody hoping beyond hope that some miracle was going to happen and you were going to get away with it. Why should you get 10% discount? Why should you get any discount? You have literally betrayed grotesquely children's safety and you've enjoyed doing so. It's reprehensible, it's disgusting, it's stomach churning, and it shouldn't be the case. These paedophilic monsters should be sent to prison literally for the rest of their natural life. I don't care whether people throw vulnerable words at the mothers saying that, you know, they were just under his influence, it was his charisma. No, it wasn't. It was their malevolence, it was their darkness, it was their depravity, it was their predisposition for paedophilic connection, and that's what they did, and that's why they accepted the treatment that Watkins bestowed on those babies. I don't believe they should be given any credit at all. Now, B, she actually did enter her plea at the very first reasonable opportunity, so she immediately did say that she was guilty. So she actually did receive 1/3 discount on her sentence. Again, I don't know why. She's banged to rights. If she hadn't have said she was guilty, they'd have just brought the videos in and gone, well, here's you doing this on video. So she was never going to get away with it. Why did you get a discount on these things? When the judge gave the sentence, they gave a total sentence to Watkins of 35 years. So he wanted to give him a really long sentence because he felt that the gravity and depravity of this crime was enormous. So the custodial term that was given to Watkins, because obviously he went guilty, therefore it wasn't a case that needed to be tried by a jury, he was given by the judge 29 years and 6 years extended period of license. Now that means that he has to serve 2/3 of the custodial term before being considered for parole. When Mr. Justice Royce was summing up this case, he described Watkins as a deeply corrupting influence, a dangerous, highly manipulative and sexual predator. And in the pre-sentence report, Watkins talked about how if he wasn't arrested, he actually didn't know what extremes he would have gone to. I mean, I think we can all imagine with the gravity of the crimes that he committed, that he's probably suggesting that maybe he would have gone as far as to kill children. That's my own insight, because he had the most devastating material. He had the highest level abuse material, graphic-wise. What would have stopped him? And he also said that his use of cocaine and methamphetamine, that had increased his sexual aggression, and that would increase his sexual aggression. So when they looked at these reports and when the justice came to the conclusion regarding the sentencing, he realised that Watkins did pose a really high risk to the public and that the public needed protection and children needed protection from Watkins, ensured by this incredibly long sentence. I know in America, he probably would never even have been given the option to potentially be released at some point, but in the UK, that particular sentence is considered a very long one. Now, when the judge was considering the sentence, they looked at, obviously, mitigating, aggravating circumstances. But some of the things that really stood out was, first of all, the enormity of the offences against the babies. The fact that these offences had been going on for a long time, so they dated back to 2007. The fact that he had an absolute enjoyment and excitement derived from abusing kids. Also, his what was described as corruptive and dominating influence over young girls. So those 16-year-olds he was pushing drugs to and having sex with. Also his drug use alongside all of the sexual assaults. The enjoyment that he seemed to get from very extreme pornography, bestiality, etc. And on top of that, an abject lack of remorse. So Ian Watkins wasn't saying sorry. Ian Watkins didn't show that he actually believed that what he'd done was wrong. Now, that in itself means you are going to be an incredibly dangerous human for the rest of your life. If you don't take responsibility, if you don't take acceptability and accountability, then you are going to potentially repeat your crimes. In fact, I would say you are very likely to repeat your crimes. And one of his passwords, just to put it out there, is I fuck kids. Yeah. Absolutely graphic and overt and the arrogance of actually using that and knowing that you know what you're putting into that computer when other people don't, that tells you just how broken he was psyche-wise. Also, a transcript of a phone conversation to a fan from prison. This is the day after admitting his guilt. The day after admitting his guilt. Showed it had all been a mega lols. Genuinely. That's what he said to this fan from prison. It's all been a mega lols. And I'm just going to put it out there that I've done a few documentaries on this absolute monster. And after those documentaries came out, I got death threats off some of his fans. Literally, even though he'd been found guilty, I got death threats. I mean, bring it on, kid. I'd like to see how you'd fare against me, genuinely, because the rage that I feel inside, if you came at me thinking that you could defend him, well, it's not going to end well for you, without a shadow of a doubt. But it demonstrates the level of delusion that these individuals had. They either believe he's innocent, even though he accepted guilt, or they believe that in spite of him being guilty, that doesn't matter because he was the lead singer of the Lost Prophets and they're attracted to him. This is how broken those psyches are within those human beings. And every single one of them, they need serious help because I think they're a danger to children as well. Because to the average human being, psychologically, emotionally, socially, familially, if you are in a situation where somebody that you know has been this grotesque and reprehensible and disgusting, you are going to go out of your way to avoid them at all costs, and rightly so. You are going to be negative about that human being, and completely understandably, you are not going to be the kind of person who defends the indefensible because it is indefensible. Also, the judge looked at the massive abuse of power, the fact that he had multiple victims, the repeated attacks on the same victims, the absolute planning and graphic details of that planning of the assaults, and also the videoing and the photographing, which was all part of the offending, that adds another aggregating factor. When it comes down to the mitigating factors that were taken into account, well, I suppose the most obvious one that the judge put forward was that he had no previous convictions, but he had been somebody who was offending for a long period of time. So he might not have had previous convictions, but that was because he wasn't caught for them, as opposed to him actually not being involved with convictions. It's just that he hadn't been brought to justice for them. Also, he'd lost a valued position in his group due to his offences. Oh God, really? Is that really a mitigating factor, Judge? Oh, that he lost everything because he was abusing children. That's a mitigating factor. That's just a rationale of reality and what happens when you do something so horrific. But also, there were letters written on behalf of those who knew him. I'm sorry, what's that? Yes, it's a mitigating factor that people who know him have written some nice letters. Nice letters are mitigating factors. Well, they are, because they show that this person can be nice as well. I'm pretty sure BTK and Ted Bundy and Richard Ramirez had good days. This is true. Listen, there wasn't a lot mitigation-wise. Give him some mitigation, Emma, please. Because arguably, we've just described in the aggravating factors that he needs to go to hell immediately. Okay, I'll give you that. But this is what happened. So some people wrote nice things about him. I would never have put pen to paper to do that. Shame on them. Shame on them. Genuinely, I don't care whether you're his mother. I don't care whether you're his friend. I don't care whether you knew him on a good day, a good week, a good year. I don't care if you played on your BMXs with him when you were kids. You should not put pen to paper to write anything positive about this absolute monster. This individual didn't snap and become this. They always were this. They will always be this. When it came down to the sentencing of the women, understandably, they didn't get as long as him, though I think they should have. B got a sentence of 14 years and P received a sentence of 17 years. Now, both are eligible for release after serving half of these terms. I mean, to me, it's just a disrespectful sentence, it really is. When you think about what they were involved in, when you think about the only reason he got to attack and abuse and destroy to some degree those children, it's because those women decided that that was an acceptable thing to let him do. You know, they abuse the trust of their children. The children are likely, with respect, to have some psychological trauma and difficulties as the result. I would say the difference between Watkins and P&B is that arguably, they seem to have shown at least some signs of remorse. I just think they're probably able to act sorry. I don't think they are sorry. I just don't believe that anyone with the capacity to put their child in the lion's den knowingly and willingly and to enjoy it can ever really truly understand what they did in a remorseful way. I just think they're remorseful they got caught. Now, Mr. Justice Royce commented that they would hopefully mature and avoid corrupting influences in the future. I think Mr. Justice Royce is absolutely delusional there. I think he's doing that classic thing where you look at a girl or a woman and you go, oh, they're only young, they're only vulnerable. Maybe if they've got time to mature, they won't be paedophiles anymore. Why are we not talking about them as child molesters? I don't understand that. And I really wanted to find some harsh, stern comments about these women. And yes, it's said that they betrayed trust, but it's more than that. And I don't believe that they're remorseful. I believe that they're sad that they got caught. Also, the judge noted that B wasn't actually suffering from any mental illness or mental health decline at the time of the crimes. Although, I don't know why that had to be introduced. Just going to throw it out there. Being mentally ill doesn't make you a predatory child molester. Just want to put that out there. There's enough stigma associated with mental health issues, aside from people throwing in the idea that that could have been a reason why they basically handed over their child to be horrifically abused. Don't buy into that at all. Have literally no connection in believing that that was a requirement to actually discuss. Being mentally unwell certainly does not make you somebody like I've just described in this case. The psychologist who dealt with P, well, they determined that P did have a mixed personality disorder. When we talk about mixed personality disorder, we're talking about predatory, paedophile, stroke sadist, stroke all-encompassing, harrowing human being of the worst description where being a mother is concerned. Is that the personality we're talking about? I'm not sure that will be found in DSM, but nonetheless, that would be my assessment. But when it came down to how they assessed them for future dangerousness, apparently both fell just short of the threshold for it. I don't know where to begin with that. So are we saying that experts literally interviewed these individuals, went through the scales, looked at potential dangerousness in the future and were like, oh, they're just not quite dangerous enough for the dangerousness profile. They handed over their children literally to a predatory child molester and they actually incited him to use violence, sadism and sexual molestation against their child. I know, but on my chart, that's not quite dangerous enough. What chart is this? I don't know, a chart that probably questionable individuals in the world of psychiatry and psychology created so that I can say they're just falling slightly less than the dangerous threshold that we would need to say that somebody was indeed dangerous. It's ridiculous. They are completely dangerous human beings. They are individuals who handed over their child to this horrible human being and they abused their children as well. Now, they said that the future risk for B reoffending is medium and the future risk of P offending is low. I kid you not. So two women who knowingly, willingly, and seem to, on an enjoyment level, get gratified by their offending, apparently aren't that dangerous and will potentially, so medium-wise, be somebody who commits crime again, or on a low level will commit crime again. So P being seen as not that dangerous at all and B being seen as potentially dangerous, but not high level. It's bonkers, sorry, it really is. Also B was classed at high risk of causing serious harm to children. No shit, Sherlock, I think we already know that. P was considered medium risk. I mean, who is doing these assessments? They're both high risk. They both did it. They both caused horrific harm to their own children. When Ian actually pled guilty, by the way, because clearly up until 2 days before the jury selection, he was just saying, I'm completely innocent. I've done absolutely nothing wrong. And he swore that. You know, he was massively convincing. When you think about a manipulator, as I said earlier on, he is a state-of-the-art, highest-level classified manipulator because they all bought into the fact that he must have been innocent. They couldn't believe for one second that he was the kind of person who would do this. And that's in spite of the fact that he was drug-addled. It's in spite of the fact that apparently there were young girls always hanging around him. Apparently when it was backstage, there were 14-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 12-year-olds there. Kids were overheard saying that they felt that he wouldn't be attracted to them because they weren't young enough. And we're talking, these are 14-year-old girls. So it surprises me that there was absolute shock. I mean, he was traveling alone in cars when the bands were traveling together because he didn't want them to see what he was up to. There was a complete detraction from the ordinary kind of typical behavior we'd expect to see. But nonetheless, the bias that they had, in spite of the fact that he was constantly surrounded by inappropriately young girls, in spite of that, his personality was such that they genuinely didn't think, up until when he confessed that he was absolutely guilty, that he was the kind of individual that he would be going ahead and doing these horrific things to children and babies. And for them, ultimately, it was a shock. And his bandmates and his own mother, that's right, his own mother, they all believed that he was wrongly accused for an entire year. Like I said, I'm surprised that his bandmates didn't have suspicions, because I've done my research and I've listened to fans talking about this, and they said that he was perpetually around really inappropriately young girls. Now, the bandmates obviously lost their lead singer. Their band was tarnished horrifically by this man's actions, but they have carried on. They've created a group called No Devotion, and that's obviously without Watkins as their lead singer. I struggle in this case to understand why they didn't uncover his crimes earlier. And I suppose one of the things that his lead guitarist said, Lee Gaze, is that you wouldn't expect a handsome rock star in his 30s to be a paedophile. And I think that bias is something that a lot of people relate to. It's not that we expect a predatory child molester to look a certain way. It's that we don't necessarily expect them to look that way. As in somebody who has everything, can have his pick of females if he wants to be in a relationship with them, can get pretty much what he wants in life, and has achieved a certain level of fame that very few people ever get to achieve. Why would somebody like that compromise and risk it all to go ahead and do what he did? Because like I said, there is a real overtness to some of the stuff he was doing. He won't just have propositioned the women that actually gave in to him, the women who actually colluded with him and the abuse of children. There'll have been many that have been before. Also, his lead guitarist, Gaze, said that Watkins did have quite a sexually voracious appetite. He had a different woman in every city. And a lot of people have that mismatch. They think that if you're interested in children, then there's no way that you're going to have normal sexual relationships. But actually, the spectrum of paedophilia is such that there are individuals who are, as I talked about earlier on, virtuous paedophiles who never go near children. They will tend to have relationships with men or women quite happily, sexually, and they'll get gratified by that. But that doesn't mean that they can't be attracted to kids as well. And then there's that sliding spectrum all the way down to the kind of individual that we've been talking about today, which is that he had this really deeply unhealthy interest and action towards children. But that doesn't mean he couldn't be attracted to adult females. We see that consistently where sexual molestation is concerned. There isn't a one-size-fit-all attitude to offending in this way. So you'll often find people who are in relationships, who are married, who've got great sexual relationships with partners, who also have this incredibly unhealthy interest in kids. Also, Gaze said that he'd never seen anyone with Watkins who was underage. I would say, like I've noted, it was very notable at concerts that there were a lot of kids going behind the scenes and that Watkins seemed, shall we say, very interested in them. Now, Gavin Allen, who's a music journalist, he did say that by the end of the tour in 2007, one of the notable things about Ian Watkins' behaviour that had shifted was that he was staying in different hotels. He was travelling in separate cars everywhere. So he was away from the band. He isolated himself away from the band, probably because he wanted to hide his behaviour from them, didn't want prying eyes into his business. And I suppose another reason why Watkins's heinous crimes didn't come to light sooner was actually down to a really, really important reality, which was a lack of action from the police. Because one of the things I haven't talked about so far is how this could have been thwarted way earlier. And when you know that there is a chain of causation, and that chain of causation could have been different if the police had actually listened to certain individuals in Watkins Live, then that means that there could have been a protective mechanism stopping some of those children meeting the horrendous things that met them. So Joanne Jadzalik's, Ian's ex-girlfriend, actually dated Watkins on and off for about 6 years. She was hopelessly in love with him. If you watch interviews with this particular woman, she talks about the fact that he would introduce really inappropriate material into conversations because she was just desperately in love with him. She kind of gave him the benefit of the doubt initially. So when she was making these accusations about him, she was actually dating him at the time. So these were things that meant that even though they were on and off throughout this particular time frame, things were really affecting her, concerning her, worrying her about Watkins' behaviour. So she warned police, she spoke to social services, and she said that Watkins was a child molester. He was a paedophilic child molester. And she started saying this in 2008. She started saying to the police and social services, the two places that you would think would want to know about this, that this man had these predisposed feelings and predilections towards children, and she felt he was acting on them. So in 2011, Joanne actually resumed contact with Ian Watkins. They'd been separated for a while. And she said at the time that the reason that she did this was she desperately wanted to find evidence against Watkins. Now, a lot of people dispute this. A lot of people say, look, you're just a bitter and scorned ex. You got back with him because you really were in love with him. He didn't give you what you wanted. And because of that, you retaliated with these kind of accusations, hoping that he would pay for letting her down. But equally, it makes sense that if you were Joanne and you had all this information and you knew that the only way that you could actually get him to confess or get people to take you seriously was to get more information against him, particularly from the horse's mouth, Watkins himself, then you may well think, I'm going to cultivate this relationship on false pretenses to get him into a false sense of security so I can then protect kids. I don't know which one of those it is, but it would make sense to me that Joanne wanted to do that, and it would make sense to me that Joanne intended to do that. So she actually reported that Watkins had given an infant cocaine. She reported that he had inappropriately touched an infant. She repeatedly got in touch with the police about this, and she was repeatedly ignored. In fact, they basically brushed her off as a disgruntled ex-girlfriend. And one detective went so far as to say that if any action was actually taken against Watkins, there would be huge publicity. And essentially, he was saying there was just this real reluctance to take her seriously because of the kickback that would occur in the press, which is completely irrelevant. We're talking about protecting kids. Why do you care about huge publicity? Surely there should be huge publicity if you've got an absolute not right child predator who's in the public eye. Everybody's going to be interested for the right reasons because we're well-adjusted humans who actually protect kids. Also, they did the classic, oh, I think you might have a problem with your mental state. What is it about the police in certain places? And I always say good things about the police when they deserve it, but I also call them into question when these kind of ridiculous ideas that they believe contribute to somebody actually talking about a reality that's playing out for them, and they get that dismissed because there's clearly something mentally unwell about you. You're a female who's really spurned by your lover, and so the consequence is that you're taking revenge by making these stories up. Absolute bubbles, it really is. And Joanne actually said that South Yorkshire Police, they believed an indecent image that she showed them in 2012 was actually of an adult, not a child. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm always confusing these adults with kids. If I'm not walking down the road and looking at 55-year-old people and thinking to myself they could be 12 or 13, I just don't know how I'm living. You know a child from an adult. She showed them an image that was indecent of a child, but they wouldn't have it. They just put it down to, again, her being incorrect and her basing that incorrect belief on her feelings towards Watkins. Now, Joanna also apparently wrote a letter to Ian's mother and also the father of a child that she thought Watkins was abusing to let them know that she was fearful about his actions. Now, in 2013, this is just going to make you question your reason for living, because genuinely when this stuff happens, it just causes you to think these protective mechanisms that just fail time and time again are absolutely devastating. And in particular, when we're talking about devastating regarding a failure to protect kids. Now, shockingly, in 2013, Joanne was actually arrested herself because she tried to entrap Watkins. This related to the possession and distribution of indecent images of children. So she was essentially caught on May the 7th, 8th, and 16th in 2011 in possession of indecent images. And between the 9th and 17th of May, so that time period, she'd actually asked Watkins to send an indecent image. On September the 30th, those images were distributed, but in a statement by a solicitor, Dale Harris, they said it was a spiteful prosecution of a woman who over a 4-year period single-handedly pursued a campaign to force the sleeping authorities to wake up to the appalling crimes against children. Now, the jury did actually reject that Joanne was complicit in Watkins' crimes, and they concluded that she had a legitimate reason for her actions. Now, in private, the police actually thanked her for bringing Watkins to justice, but in public, they prosecuted her for the efforts that she literally made to ensnare him. It's disgusting. Joanne said it was basically her against the world, with everyone calling her a liar. And it seems grossly unfair when you think that she initially reported Ian Watkins to the police in 2008, and they actually told her at that point she had no evidence. So they informed her, you have no evidence, we cannot act without evidence. So what did she do? She went out and she collected the evidence. She collected it in the hopes that Watkins would be punished, and she gets prosecuted as a result. Where is the justice in that? And when you actually read comments on YouTube videos and Reddit blogs, I'll tell you, there's a lot of people that don't even believe in Joanne's innocence. So on one level, it could be really controversial for me to strongly agree that she was trying to bring Ian to justice, but I do believe she was. You know, there are comments calling her absolutely disgusting, revolting names. Bear in mind, she was found innocent. And it's a very emotive issue. If you are on a jury and you are looking at an individual and you are considering that individual to potentially be a child molester of some sorts, contact or non-contact crimes, it's a long way for a jury to peddle to a position where they find you innocent without very clear evidence. So I appreciate why some people will question her integrity. Some people will continue to question the fact that she was being honest about this on the basis that she continued to date him, continued to sleep with him after reporting him. But others are incredibly supportive of her. They really do feel that she deserves congratulations. She deserves to be considered a bit of a hero here. And also that the jury 100% made the correct decision in finding her not guilty. Now, one of the problems that we have is clearly an issue with the way that the police acted. So this led to an IPCC, Independent Police Complaints Commission investigation, which looked at how reports about Watkins had been handled by the South Wales Police over a 4-year time frame. So there were reports made against Watkins as early as 2008. And what they found was that police just missed numerous opportunities to bring him to justice. First of all, they didn't view Joanne as a credible witness. So that was one of the problems that they believed existed, even though it didn't. She was totally credible. They didn't examine Joanne's phone in 2009. This contained a message from Watkins expressing that he wanted to have sex with children. Joanne even made a complaint about a lack of police action. This didn't get investigated at the time. It is unbelievable, isn't it? Where somebody is just repeatedly trying to get help and they just ignore them again. And again, for good measure, let's just ignore her fully. Let's just make it, in fact, that when she walks anywhere near the police station, an alarm goes off and we can lock the door so she can't even get in. You know, it's incredulous, isn't it, that all of these complaints with no investigation. And Joanne wasn't the only person trying to alert the police about Watkins' deviant behaviour. In fact, South Wales Police had 8 reports and 3 intelligence logs from 6 different people, all about the fact that they thought this man was a predatory child abuser, and the police just didn't act on any of them. Watkins wasn't even questioned as a result of those reports. The police didn't even bother to visit the alleged victim that Joanna reported. It is unbelievably irresponsible, inappropriate, completely unprofessional, and a deviation from serving and protecting those they're meant to serve and protect. And also, the police had already received reports on his drug use. None of those were acted on until 2012. They obviously felt more comfortable acting on the drug allegations than they did the child abuse allegations, which on a serious spectrum seems bizarre. And bear in mind, the prior allegations about drug use were really well-founded. Arresting Watkins for the drug offences would have interrupted his child abuse. So why hadn't they acted on those prior to 2012? Because they had the information, which clearly demonstrated he was selling drugs, he was involved in high-level drug offences, and if they'd taken his equipment, then they would have found all this material and protected children being abused for longer periods of times. So when they came to the conclusions and findings in the IPCC investigation, they raised so many disturbing concerns. So they said there was a weakness in South Wales police procedures relating to allegations of child abuse. This included really poor record keeping, poor retention of records, poor management of intelligence, poor safeguarding, poor supervision. And these are the very things that are required to ensure that children are 100% protected. The whole premise when you are investigating these kind of things and you are recording the information that is vital is you have to keep an open mind. You have to follow up allegations that are made. Even if you don't believe those allegations, you need to also recognise your potential for unconscious bias, i.e., well, he's famous, rich, good looking. Why would he be compromising his life by doing any of these things? That doesn't matter. What matters is the information suggests that this individual is acting in a way where lots of different people have reported him. Go and do the investigation. And also, it's really important that they consistently in the police challenge these kind of biases by training again and again and again. Because no matter who you are born and brought up in a certain environment. Your mindset is created by the psyche of many people around you. If they have biases, often you inherit them without even knowing. And then if you're exposed to a certain stereotype of, shall we say, criminal, you start to believe that there is a stereotype about this is how someone looks like in this case. This is how someone acts like in this case. This person doesn't meet the same set of principles and ideas that I have about this particular type of offender. And that can create a prison where your mind just will not allow you to consider that it is possible that somebody doesn't have to look, act, sound, or seem to appear like the kind of individual that you've built up in your brain would appear if they were doing this particular type of crime. Now, the NSPCC, they described the findings of this particular investigation as damning. Damning. They said there were a catalogue of basic failures. An unchecked mobile phone could have helped to prevent further abuse. The consequences of the force's failings was arguably that a predatory paedophile offended over an extended period of time. And the NSPCC are 100% correct. Now, we all know Ian Watkins is locked up for a very long period of time. And my God, he does not deserve to breathe free air ever, in my opinion. But we all know that when you are a predatory child molester, particularly if you're a predatory child molester who also isn't necessarily considered a kind of criminal that would be used to the experience of being incarcerated, therefore, not only are you being found guilty of the worst crime possible, which is abusing and molesting children in prison, don't go down well for you, but also you're not somebody who understands how to, shall we say, cope in an incarcerated position, and that means that you are potentially more likely to meet bullies, meet people who are very angry with you, and you don't necessarily have the tools to know how to look after yourself in those situations. And I hope that he is in that situation because he deserves to be in a position where he's bullied. He deserves to be in a position where he is aggressed for his actions. I genuinely think that child abuse of this magnitude is one of the worst crimes that is possible, aside from actually murdering children in this way as well. So he is the lowest of the low, and I know that a lot of prisoners are going to treat him that way. And interestingly, on Saturday, August the 5th of this year, so 2023, West Yorkshire Police were notified by staff at HMP Wakefield of an assault on a prisoner. So on that Saturday evening, turns out that Ian Watkins, disgraced former Lost Prophets singer, had been stabbed in jail. Apparently, incident occurred where Watkins was taken hostage by a group of prisoners. Apparently, they were irritated about him giving guitar lessons to other inmates, but I don't think it will be the guitar lessons that have irritated them too much. But apparently, he was kidnapped for hours and hours and hours until a specially trained unit were able to enter the cell in which Watkins was actually being held and free him. Now, when he was taken out of the cell, turns out he'd already been stabbed multiple times, according to reports. Now, his injuries are understood not to be life-threatening and inquiries are ongoing, but I think it's suffice to say that the prisoners don't think it's acceptable that a predatory child molester of the gravity that we've discussed today gets to give guitar lessons to other people. Some may think that's pro-social for him to be able to go and do that. Some may think it's helpful to educate prisoners in guitar playing, but I don't know. A lot of us wouldn't want somebody near us who had done what I've talked about today. I'm not saying he deserved to be stabbed. I'm just saying if you don't want to get stabbed in prison, don't viciously molest babies. Just throwing it out there. Bit of life advice. I'd be so interested to know your thoughts on this. It's been quite a long one. I went into depth about the counts and charges because I think it's really, really important. I hope you've learnt something that you didn't ordinarily know already. And please let me know in the comments your own thoughts and feelings about this. Like I said, it took me a long time to do this one because there was a lot of information to go through, a lot of research to be done. But I do genuinely feel that at least the sentence does respect and also reflect the gravity of his actions. Although, like I said, ideally, this guy should never, ever get to walk the streets again. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.